This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we had a chilly and wet spring, but it is leading now into some beautiful summer-like temperatures, and that means it is time for a visit with our favorite horticulturist, Ron Smith, in studio live to take your questions. Ron, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ashley.
The number to call is 888-755-6377. You can also email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public. The number one more time, 888-755-6377. We're still in early June. Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of things we should be doing right now in our lawns and gardens?
Well, the bluegrass lawns, which we mostly have across the upper Midwest, is starting to show some seed heads. And the common questions that people ask is, what do I do about the seed heads? How can I get rid of them? Well, most, you don't want to get rid of them. That's just a consequence of the plant going through the various life cycles. It's a long day plant. The days are getting longer, so that's when the bluegrass plant sets its seed. People think they can go ahead and keep it from going to seed by lowering the mowing height, getting rid of the seed heads. All it does is reform again below the height that they just last mowed it at. Mm. And in fact, bluegrass, in particular called the annual bluegrass, is a curse to the golf course superintendents around the state. And when they try to keep them out of the putting greens, because at that whisker length that they cut that bent grass green, the Poa annua, the annual bluegrass, will set that tiny little seed head, which, according to golfers that are really serious about their game, that little seed head can mess up their putting game. So it's not going to go away. It's going to go away on its own maybe about this time in July, and then you won't see any more seed heads, and you'll have a very beautiful-looking lawn.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The number to call, 888-755-6377. Ron Smith live in studio during our afternoon broadcast. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, you can always email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org.
One other question, yes. If I can add.
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, lilacs are in bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And with lilacs in bloom, that means the crabgrass is beginning to germinate around the edges of your sidewalks and driveways. They like the hot locations. And so you're probably not going to recognize it. You'll just be seeing it coming up as a little seedling. And it's no big deal right now, but it really annoys people as we get into the summer months and the weather gets hotter. You get into the fall and it gets these finger-like seed heads showing up. And that makes it very difficult to control. You can control it with a pre-emergent if you can get it down a little bit before, about 2 or 3 weeks before the lilacs actually come into bloom. That's the best way to control it. And you can also get it as a post-emergent. So if you've had a history of crabgrass showing up around the edge of your driveway or your sidewalk, you can go to a local garden center and they have a Scott's product out there that will take care of broadleaf weeds, the dandelions, which we just got through seeing go into flower and go to seed. It'll take care of those seedlings coming up there with the dandelions as well as the seedlings coming up of the crabgrass. So very, very, very adaptable plants and very easy to go ahead and control if you can get them earlier.
Do crabgrass and lilacs have anything in common besides they kind of come at the same time?
They like the same temperature. That's about the only common thing they have.
Okay. I was wondering. It's like, why are you talking about lilacs?
Yeah. The lilacs give them a signal. It's okay to go ahead and germinate now, crabgrass. You're safe.
I do have a question about my own lilacs, and I think this is the fourth, maybe fifth spring,
mm-hmm.
And it's really the first spring that they have started to grow nice and tall and have some good blossoms. Mm-hmm. Is there anything I need to be doing now?
With the lilacs?
Yeah.
Well, obviously people grow lilacs because of their beautiful flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really want to keep the flowers going strong, as they start to fade and lose color, if you can cut them back before they start forming seed heads or seed pods, I should say, because that's a requirement that requires energy being put into the production of that seed. So if you can keep the plant from doing that, you'll get a little bit better blooming taking place next spring.
Okay.
And so it's just one of those things. Lots of people don't think about it until they say, oh, those ugly seed heads, and they kind of get in
there.
When
do those start to show up?
They should. Well, let's see. They're in flower now. They'll probably show up about the end of – around the 4th of July.
Okay.
You'll start to notice them.
So and how far cut back?
Not too far.
Okay.
Because it'll go ahead and set the – if you do it then you'll be able to get plenty of blooming. If you do it too late, then you're probably going to miss out on some of the blooms next year. You don't want to get into fall pruning of lilacs if you can help it.
Horticulturist Ron Smith live in studio. Give us a call at 888-755-6377. You can find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public, or you can send us an email. We are mainstreet@prairiepublic.org for that email. And we do have a question from Marie in Fargo, who has some juniper and cedar bushes at her house that she's looking to replace and wants to replace them with ornamental grasses.
Oh.
And just looking for a recommendation on your favorite kind of ornamental grass and why.
Well, I have a couple of favorites, and one of the favorites is everybody's favorite, and that's the Carol Forrester feather reed grass. And you see it growing essentially everywhere. It's durable. It's literally maintenance-free, and it looks attractive. It sways in the wind. You don't have to worry about it breaking off like you do with tree branches and everything else. It makes a nice screen. It gets to be about 6 feet tall and a nice spreading clump and everything else.
They do
best in full sun.
Okay.
And the other thing that's nice about it is you don't have to fertilize it. There's no insects that bother it. The only thing you might find is that bunnies might decide to go ahead and nest in there over the winter months if you're not a fan of bunnies, which most homeowners
most
are not because
aren't.
Of what they do to your landscape.
Right.
So. And then the other one, of course, is the native grass to North Dakota, and that's the big blue stem prairie grass. And that's a beautiful plant. That's a rhizomaceous. It's slowly rhizomaceous. In other words, it'll start to spread very slowly. It's not going to be an invasive grass, but it'll spread and fill in an area very, very nicely. And this too gets to be about six and a half feet tall. Very beautiful feathery type foliage or flowers, I should say. And it's one of my favorites, again, because it doesn't have any particular problems. If you don't want one that big, then they have the short cousin to
Carol Forrester or the blue stem?
They have the big blue stem.
Sorry.
Yeah, the big blue stem. I'm sorry about the mental gap there. But it's a little blue stem, and that's not rhizomaceous, and it makes a nice little individual hedge about a little bit more than knee high, maybe mid thigh high on the average person. And it's also very, very attractive. So you've got a couple of good grasses there that would do very well.
What is the designation? What are the qualities that make something an ornamental grass? Is it height? Is it color? Is it that it won't spread?
Well, the things that make any plant ornamental is the attractiveness. It has something going for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to be invasive. It's going to have qualities that are going to be good in as many parts of the growing season as possible and the non-growing season as well. So you can have ornamental grasses that will look good through a good part of the winter months showing up above the snow, which mm-hmm. can get pretty monotonous to look at with all the white around, if you can remember back 2 months ago, we were wondering if it was ever going to disappear. So that makes it good, and this is what we look for in any kind of a woody plant as well. We have some Diablo nine barks growing in our backyard. Diablo has a nice reddish-brown stem or reddish-brown leaves, beautiful little white flowers, and it's very, very striking. It looks good all summer long, spring, summer, and into the fall. And in the wintertime, the nine bark, the bark itself, is kind of a birch-like bark. It's kind of exfoliating, and it's very attractive. Again, that's my perception of it, and obviously the perception to a lot of people out there. So it's a very popular plant to go ahead and stick in the ground and watch it grow. It grows very vigorously, can be shaped very nicely, or you can just let it go ahead and grow as a freelance type of shrub or hedge.
Horticulturist Ron Smith live in studio. 888-755-6377 is your direct line to our expert. You can also email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public. We do have another email question about ornamental grasses, so they are very popular. This person has been trying to figure out the name of an ornamental grass that he has seen at a few spots around West Fargo, specifically the Cheyenne Crossings Assisted Living Facility. It's tall and is white, long, gorgeous plumage. Has also seen it at the Titan Machinery Building.
I think I've seen it.
Do you know what this is?
Yeah, I have a pretty good idea of what it is. It's one called Miscanthus sinensis gracilimus. And if you just go and ask for a Miscanthus sinensis at a local nursery, you'll probably be able to find it. If the local nursery doesn't have it, you can certainly order it in online. I hate to say it, but probably Amazon can get it for you if you want. And pardon the commercial for Amazon, but it's just one of those things. It's readily available if you just look a little bit.
And if you can't remember a word like Miscanthus sinensis, I already can't remember it. Is there a more common name here?
There probably is, but I can't bring it to mind right now. If I think of it throughout the program here, I'll say, aha, this is what it is.
Horticulturist Ron Smith live in studio. Give us a call, 888-755-6377. Ron, you sent an email that you wanted to talk about leaf drop of ash trees.
Yes. This is after the barn door. We're worried about it. The barn door was open. The leaves fell. And bingo. Now we're concerned about it. Now we don't need to be concerned about it.
Okay.
Because the problem has already passed. It's actually an anthracnose fungus that happens on ash trees almost every single spring. It happens during a wet, cool spring. Just as the leaf bud scales are falling off. If you can remember, Ashley, going back at least 2 to maybe 3 weeks ago, you get up one day and you look around the driveway and the sidewalk and you see all this messy stuff on the sidewalk and you wonder what it is. Well, those were under the ash trees. Well, those were the leaf bud scales that had been knocked off with the expanding leaves. It's at that point you start having this damp, cool, rainy weather, and this fungus can go ahead and get started. Well, it doesn't do anything until the leaves start to unfold. And then you get about 10 to 25 to 30% of the leaves dropping right off, and that's it. And so it's, everybody panics. Everybody panics about it. What's happening to my ash trees? Is this the bronze, the emerald ash borer? No, it's not the emerald ash borer, I promise you.
I hope not.
No. But it's one of those things that it comes and it goes. There's nothing you can do about it. And most trees will be able to tolerate it quite easily.
We have an email question that just came in, and some people sent a photo for you to look at and said, what's wrong with our linden tree?
Really?
And so we'll just describe this. Nice big leaves on the linden tree, and then it looks like a bunch of green warts, basically.
Yeah, that's a good description. It's like a redheaded child saying, Mommy, why do I have freckles on my face? Is it going to hurt me? No, it's not going to hurt you. Those are cysts that come about from mites or very, very small insects going ahead and feeding on the linden foliage. You see them on maples lots of times. Silver maples are very prone to these little galls that show up. It's not going to hurt the tree at all. That's really just something you can kind of look at and say, well, this is Mother Nature working hard to battle its own particular problems. There's nothing you can do about it. They're encased in that little cyst there, so all the spraying in the world is not going to get rid of them. If you wanted to try to control them, you'd have to have incredibly perfect timing at the time that they're actively feeding and the little young leaves just beginning to open up. You have to have that insecticide on there, and it's just way too much trouble to try to get the timing just right, and you don't like to be putting a lot of insecticides into the air to control literally a harmless insect that actually makes the tree look a little bit more ornamental.
Is it somewhat specific to a linden tree?
Well, each tree species has their own little cyst, a little mite or insect that causes these little galls, and there's a whole section and a good entomology book that'll have gall-forming insects that are several pages thick. And it's an amazing thing to look at. I mean, they really are quite interesting.
You can give Ron Smith a call at 888-755-6377 or email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public. We'll have more with Ron after this break.
Can a preschool program affect students 50 years after they were in the classroom?
These people are healthier. They also have less crime, more earnings.
Can it affect their kids?
What you see is beneficial effects that go on to the next generation.
The Lessons That Last, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg in studio with Ron Smith, and he is our horticulturist we have in studio periodically during the growing season. Go ahead, give us a call. Get your questions answered at 888-755-6377. Email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook. We are Main Street at Prairie Public. And Ron, during the break, you mentioned you wanted to talk about herbaceous perennials.
Herbaceous perennials, but I'd also like to thank Joyce from Jamestown for sending in a very good photograph of the problem that she saw on her leaves.
When you get
man, oh man,
photos.
If we could do that just about every time people have a question, that would make it a lot easier to give an accurate answer.
Well,
yes.
It is nice that cell phones have such good cameras these days. Well, I don't know if that's a cell phone pic,
yeah.
But all right, herbaceous perennials,
okay.
What you got?
As one gets older, one finds gardening a little bit more challenging, especially if you have to get down on the ground and get back up again, get down on the ground and get back up again.
Yeah,
so you start looking at 36,
it's really hard.
You're young in age, you're saying that? Okay, yes. So what you look for is something that you can put in the ground that's going to have seasonal color and it's going to look good. It's going to sequester the weeds. It's not going to be invasive. Remember, you were asking me about what makes something ornamental or not ornamental. Well, it's something that you can plant, admire its beauty. It kind of takes care of itself. And there are a number of perennial plants that are my favorites that I like that do that very, very well. And I'll kind of name them slowly so people can copy them down if they want to, if they don't know anything about them. One of them, of course, at the top of the list is the echinacea or the coneflower. And the breeders have gotten into that since it was proven so popular about 20 years ago. The native coneflower was very, very popular back then. So breeders got into it and we have to jazz this plant up. So there's all kinds. You have the native coneflowers that are out there and you have the new introductions that have been hybridized. They're nice plants. You can put them in and just more or less forget about them. Totally. They attract the pollinators. Butterflies, especially the monarch butterflies, love them. Young honeybees will go after them as well, but mostly butterflies, the monarch butterflies. And speaking of butterflies, another good one is the butterfly weed, the Asclepias, which is very beautiful yellow flower. And don't let the word weed fool you, but it's also very, very attractive. Along with that is one called the Joe Pye weed. And that's quite a good-sized perennial that gets to be about 4 or 5 feet tall and has big flower heads. My favorite one that is just starting to fade right now is the Virginia bluebells, Mertensia. And it's a good little plant that grows maybe about 2 feet high and spreads about 2 feet. Has a little tiny bluebell flower. It's ideal for the north side or shade, but it'll also grow in full sun. It comes out around this time of year, looks good, and then as the summer encroaches, it dries up and dies back, and then it's dropped its seed, and so you can get it coming back again year after year from its own self-seeding. It doesn't become invasive. It's not a weed, but it's a very, very beautiful, delicate-looking plant. That's the Virginia bluebells, Mertensia. Another good one, my favorite, are the sedums. Anybody, and I do mean anybody, can grow sedum. And if you have, say, Ron, everything I touch dies. Okay. The sedum will not. You can go ahead, if you have a friend that has sedum growing in their property, you can ask them, may I have some of your sedum to go ahead and grow? They'll rip it out of the ground, hand it to you, you take it, stick it in the ground before it dries, and it'll grow.
Mm-hmm.
I promise you it'll grow. And it grows nicely. It spreads without getting in too invasive. So if you have a...
It's kind of carpet-like. Some of them are pretty carpet. Some of them get the big. And you can really walk on them like grass,
well,
right?
Well, somewhat. The only thing that has the wearability is grass itself.
Okay.
Sedum will take an occasional step on, but you can't walk on it or play any kind of a game on it. It's something to look back and appreciate. If you have stone walks in your garden... And there's stone that you step on in your garden.
And the sedum in between.
Sedum in between it is perfect. It will not be invasive. It's absolutely perfect. So that's one of my favorite ones there. If you have a hot, dry area that gets baked in the sun and you don't like to get out in water because of the mosquito population here in North Dakota, there's two of them that I like. One is called Russian sage. And I think anybody that's ever come close to a Russian sage will never forget it because it has a very aromatic foliage, kind of a grayish-green foliage, and it probably smells like Vicks VapoRub that your mother used to put on your throat when you had a sore throat or your chest when you felt a little bit croupy. It does very well.
Is that another bee-friendly one?
Yes, a very bee-friendly one. Okay. Absolutely. It is very good. Tough, drought-tolerant, heat-tolerant. What else can I say about it? If you rip it out of the ground and you leave a part of it in there, it'll come back again. But it's not invasive. You know, you say, oh, gosh, I thought I'd like this thing, but I really don't. I just don't like it. You know, it's just too rambly. And the go along with it is the aromatic aster. And any kind of an aster does very, very well at flowers in the fall of the year. And then to throw in another one here that's often nice in a perennial bed are the oriental poppies that you can go ahead and scatter in amongst other herbaceous perennials, and you'll get the oriental poppies coming up there and looking very, very attractive. So those are some of my initial favorite ones to go ahead and work with.
Are you going
to
hate me if I tell you that one of my favorite perennials is dandelions?
Oh, you know, everybody hates dandelions.
But I don't. They're one of my favorites.
You might as well go ahead and accept them. They're going to be as permanent as death and taxes. So.
The roots are very good for you.
There's no way you're ever going to get rid of all the dandelions in the world.
Well, and with the tap roots, aren't they bringing nutrients to the top of the soil? Aren't they kind of creating a healthier soil around?
Who is?
Dandelions.
No, I've never heard of anything like that.
Okay.
Well, let's stop and think about it for a second. Dandelion... The flowers make good dandelion wine, and I've tasted some good dandelion wine. Young dandelion leaves make good salad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, young dandelion leaves. Dandelion root, somebody has told me, makes a coffee substitute. Well, I'm a coffee lover, and I can't believe that the word good should prefix that. Dandelion root makes a good
I think coffee perhaps soup. If you've never had coffee, it might be okay.
Okay. But it's a very determined plant, and I think we need to do a little bit more research on it. Yeah, as far as, you know, why is it so determined? Are we being told something by Mother Nature that we should pay more attention to than just to go ahead and get rid of it? Maybe we should. I don't know.
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Horticulturist Ron Smith is, well, now he's asking questions, but you can ask your questions when you call 888-755-6377. You can email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org, or you can find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public. He will be back in the second half of our show, but now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Democrats on the Legislative Management Committee say the committee chair, House Majority Leader Chet Pollard, did not live up to a commitment made that Democrats would be chairing some interim study committees. But Pollard disputes that. 2 years ago, Democratic lawmakers chaired two interim committees. And House Minority Leader Joshua Boucher of Fargo says he had a commitment from Pollard that Democrats would have the gavel on four committees. Only one Democratic Representative Cory Mock of Grand Forks has a chairmanship. He will chair the Interim Information Technology Committee. Committee Democrats tried to put Bismarck Senator Erin Oban as chair of Education Policy, a committee she chaired last interim, and Valley City Senator Larry Robinson to chair Higher Education. Both motions failed on a party line vote. Boucher told reporters,
"Today was an opportunity for us to set that record straight, to make sure that we got that chair position, whether it was for Senator Oban or Senator Robinson, and just unfortunate that the Republican majority wasn't able to follow through with that commitment."
But Pollard said he had approached Democrats about sharing committees, but they had turned him down, saying they were not the committees they wanted.
"So I feel I lived up to my portion because I asked him, I will give you a chairman of an interim committee. Do you want it?" And they turned that particular one down, you know. So if you don't take one, but there's 20 more, there was that availability.
Democrats will be vice chairs of four committees. The education budget Minnesota Governor Tim Walz recently signed into law was passed during the legislature's special session. The $48 billion budget ended up being a compromise between Republicans and Democrats. Minnesota Education Commissioner Mary Catherine Ricker says it goes a long way to making Minnesota the education-rich state it aspires to be. The budget contains funding for tribal contract schools. It increases the basic education funding formula four times more than the Senate initially wanted and includes a cross-subsidy for special education to ensure it is fully funded. Governor Walz says the budget makes education attractive in Minnesota for both students and educators.
"We want Minnesota, when people think across this nation, where would I like to send my kids to public schools? It would be in Minnesota. And if I'm a young teacher, just like what brought my wife and I to Mankato, where do we want to teach? A place where we're valued, a place where there's the resources and the opportunity to innovate in your own classroom to make a difference, and that's Minnesota."
The budget also ensures the retainer of 4,000 pre-kindergarten seats throughout the state. And roundabouts are becoming more popular across North Dakota. Traffic engineers say they're safer than normal intersections. Justin Schlosser is a traffic operations engineer with the North Dakota Department of Transportation.
"You have lower speeds going into an intersection. You also, what we have, reduced conflict points, and those are points that vehicles can collide or run into each other. And that is significantly less in a roundabout compared to a signalizer or stop control intersection, just because everyone's going in the same direction. It eliminates high speed right angle or T-bone crashes and also eliminates head-on crashes."
Schlosser says roundabouts also improve traffic flow. He says DOT has 8 roundabouts on the state highway system and says they're becoming more popular in cities and counties. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg in studio with horticulturist Ron Smith, taking your lawn and garden questions. Go ahead and call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. You can also email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public. And just before the news, we were talking about some favorite perennials.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a very limited understanding about what a self-seeding annual is.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a perennial will come back every year in the same spot, and a self-seeding annual comes back but maybe not in the same spot? Or why wouldn't you have any self-seeding annuals on your on your list of plants to come back every year?
Oh, that's a very, very good question, and I wish you had prompted me on that a little bit. But it's
this is live, baby. Just go with it.
Anyhow, it's a perennial in the sense that you can depend on it to come back. Let me break it down into annuals, perennials, and biennials.
Okay.
An annual is something that flowers all summer long. And 99.9% of the time, it doesn't reseed itself successfully to come back up again in our climate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the perennial can be sustain itself either through a crown that's hardy, cold hardy, or a root system that will go ahead and send out new vegetative growth in the following year, as well as setting out seed that'll go ahead and come back again. And one of the best examples I can think of is the Shasta daisy, which my wife and I have found new mussels pulling out of the ground.
They're everywhere.
Yeah, they're everywhere. And so don't get started on Shasta daisies unless you really are madly in love with them, because they will show their love for the space that you've given them, and they'll take over, and they'll just become an obnoxious weed as far as I'm concerned. And then you have the biennial that is vegetative the first year, no flowers,
mm-hmm.
produces a, comes back the next year, produces a flower, drops the seed, and the plant itself dies. So that's a biennial. So I would say until somebody can get their nose into an encyclopedia, plant encyclopedia, and say, Ron, this is what it is, but I would call Mertensia or Virginia bluebells a perennial because and the plant itself doesn't come back next year, but you do get plants coming back from that plant, okay, from the seed that that plant drops. So is it perennial or not? I really can't give you a hard answer on that, actually. Very, very good question.
Sounds like a discussion for Jeff Russell Weinstein to take up.
I'll have to look
here.
That up. It is classified as a perennial.
Horticulturist Ron Smith in studio. The number to call is 888-755-6377. And on the line we have Dennis in Moorhead.
Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Ron. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a quick question on an arborvitae.
Mm-hmm.
I planted 6 or 7 of them in a row for landscaping down at the lake
mm-hmm.
to build a somewhat of a privacy wall.
Sure.
And with the deer,
oh,
I don't know if it's the cold weather, the last 3 winters in the center, they've turned so brown.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there's something I can do or if they're just going to recover on their own.
Well, I think the best thing you can hope for is that they will recover on their own. And I without seeing the extent of the damage from the deer will go ahead and strip the arborvitae right down to the bark. For as long as their necks can reach or as high as they can stand on their hind legs and eat it. And so many times it's one of those things that you're trying to do anything to make it better. You're frustrating yourself. You're going after something that you can't correct. Either let nature take its course, and if it just gets too ugly for you to tolerate, get it out of there and replant again. I'm a big proponent, I should say, of a deer repellent called Plantskydd, PlantSkydd.
It works for me, too.
Yeah, it works beautifully. It's the best thing. It was developed, I think, in Sweden, and it's kind of gotten a foothold here in America. Grape growers use it to protect their grapevines from the grazing deer during the winter months.
And it's blood, right?
Huh?
It's blood?
I have no idea what it is.
If I'm using the same stuff, I think
it's Plantskydd.
It's got a strange-looking name.
Like, what?
Beef.
That isn't English. No, it's not.
Like a cow blood or
something. Yeah. Whatever it does, it works. It does. That absolutely works. And so look for that. You can order it online if you want to, but I'm seeing it more and more in some of the local nurseries and possibly even some of the big box stores. So that's something to go ahead and control that that with.
Any fertilizer?
Well, you can try
fertilizer or trimming the top of the to help the bottom or the center grow in.
No, I wish I could give you good news. Trimming the top, it depends on how tolerant you are to asymmetry, disfigured looking trees. Ashley's laughing. I used to sell.
You mean natural looking?
Well, natural looking. Okay. I used to work for a Christmas tree farmer back in 100 years ago. And people would always come in. I knew exactly what they wanted. You want a nice tree about 5 or 6 feet tall, nicely symmetrically shaped. How did you know that, Ron? Oh, I've been around a long time. Yeah, 18, 20 years old. But every now and then you'd want somebody that would come in and say, I want to see what you consider your ugliest tree. Oh, well, this is where the tractor turns around the corner there, and the guy runs over it just about every time. Well, you have this gnarled, twisted-looking, ugly tree that not even Charlie Brown would want to have to try to decorate at Christmas time. And doggone it, they buy it. You know, and you don't – what are you going to charge me for it? I don't know. Glad to get rid of it. Just take it out of here. Just don't tell them that you got it from us. You know, that kind of kind of a thing. So it depends on how much you can tolerate what is not normal for their growth habit. Am I answering your question?
Somewhat. I thought if I trimmed the top into a cone shape, maybe it would force the bottom to grow in a little fuller.
Well, try it and see if it works. I'm not going to say it. It absolutely does not work. Because
okay.
As soon as I say that, somebody will call up and say, Smith, you're wrong. I did this 20 years ago, and it's back to its absolutely beautiful shape. So give it a try. It's worth a college try.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Good luck with the deer, Dennis.
Yeah.
Ron Smith, available at 888-755-6377 or via email mainstreet@prairiepublic.com. We do have an email about the benefits of replacing grass with a clover lawn, mm-hmm. wondering specifically what are the benefits of that and is there a type that would do well in eastern North Dakota, and anything else to know about this?
Well, I'm not going to try to pass myself off as a clover expert by any means. My experience with clover goes back into the 50s when clover was a part of the grass seed mixes that people could buy. And I would have Kentucky bluegrass, perennial rye, and some fescue, and clover. And when it would be spread out over the lawn, the grass would come up, but so also would the clover. And this is before the days of the automatic irrigation system taking hold. And so the grass would go dormant during the hot summer months, and the clover would stay green. It also produced a little white flower. This is the white Dutch clover that's commonly found and was commonly found in grass seed mixes. Well, then the chemical companies got started, and they decided that white Dutch clover was a weed, and it needed to be eliminated from lawns because it made them look ugly because of the patchy greens and the different textures and the white flowers, which stung little children, you know, as they went barefoot through the clover and everything else. Okay, so now you're asking me, will it make a good mat? It probably will. It's a good nitrogen-fixing plant. You don't ever have to mow the doggone stuff. It looks nice and green, and it has these little white flowers around them.
Well, and it's interesting, about a week or two ago, I saw an article in a paper that comes out of Minneapolis, and mm-hmm. the state of Minnesota is helping Minnesota homeowners who want to turn part of their lawn mm-hmm. into bee-friendly areas.
Okay.
And one of the things that they recommended doing and would help pay for is to replace the grass with clover.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and I think it was the white clover.
Yeah, well, the thing, I have to admit that I've never seen a pure white clover planting.
Yeah.
I've seen.
Well, I don't think it was a total replacement,
okay.
but in patches.
Oh, well,
kind of like a biodiversity is good.
Well, you're taking a step back, you know, 50, 60 years ago, what I was used to.
Everything old is new again.
Yeah, that's right. Everything old is new again. My gosh, look what we discovered. Yeah, my grandfather knew that too.
Right. Yeah. Now we just know the science a little bit.
Yeah.
We're not discovering.
Yeah. So, yeah.
We have on the line Scott in Williston.
Hi, Scott.
Hello. I'm calling from Williston, but I actually live in Minnesota.
That's okay.
My problem is in Minnesota.
Okay.
I have a weed in my lawn, and it grows pretty low to the ground, except in the spring. It sends up a stalk, probably 6, maybe even 8 inches, and there's kind of a white, fuzzy flower on the end of this, and it's, I don't know the scientific name. I've looked it up on the internet, and it's called pussy toes because the shape of the flower is kind of like a cat's foot.
Yeah, yeah, pussy toes. Yeah, I can.
And it is impossible to get rid of. I have sprayed it repeatedly with different concentrations, and I've gotten to the point where I've started to kill the lawn, but this weed seems impossible to kill. And I was wondering if you know about it or have any ideas.
I have heard of it. Have you tried Roundup on it?
Well, no, I haven't tried that.
Well, you can,
I think that's going to be my only course, though, because nothing else seems to even phase it whatsoever.
Yeah, it's kind of an unusual weed to have. I've maybe heard of it maybe 3 or 4 times in my entire life, and I've been around a long time. And so it's one of those weeds that in the past people say, just dig the doggone thing out if you can. And
yeah.
But it's an interesting weed as far as
It's slowly spreading, yeah. And I've talked to some of my neighbors, mm-hmm. and they're getting it too. And oh, yeah, it's something I'd never seen before. I've had it for several years now, but mm-hmm. it's something, I don't know if it was introduced in grass seed or what. But
no. I used to work for a seed company, and I can guarantee you they are fanatically fussy about the cleanliness of their seed. I mean, they will make very, very sure that it's as clean as they can humanly possibly get it and still be able to sell it at a price that you'd want to buy it for.
Would vinegar work?
I have no idea, Ashley, and no idea at all.
I will give you one suggestion. Mm-hmm. I haven't tried it yet. A neighbor of mine said that he had heard that if you fertilize it with a fertilizer that has no nitrogen, that creates an environment it doesn't like. I haven't tried it yet. I just thought I'd throw that out there to see if you thought it held any truth to it.
You know, that's that is interesting because I'm going to look this up when we get off the air here today, and I don't know how we'd ever get back together again, but I'll certainly send out whatever I find here to the station, to Ashley. So
okay.
If you want to keep in touch with,
Scott, you can go ahead and send an email to mainstreet@praypublic.org, mm-hmm. and then we'll have your contact info and can either send it to Ron or just
fact, I'll
send you.
Make a note here. Look
Ron's
up Pussy
response.
Toes here.
Okay.
Try to get back to you. And thank you again for your call.
Yeah, I've never heard of these.
That's a good one.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
The number to call is 888-755-6377. You can also email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Ron, how can you tell when a tomato plant needs to be watered?
How can you tell when it needs to be watered?
Like, do you need to water tomatoes every day?
Well, you should.
Okay.
At least to begin with. And once it also depends on where you're having them grown. If you're growing them in the ground, mm-hmm. it might not be necessary after the first week to 10 days because they're very prolific at producing roots. They have mm-hmm. what's called pre-stem. The stems have pre-root initials in them. Okay, I'll make it that out straight. So there's a potential for new roots to come out of the stem. That's why you bury a tomato plant as deep as you do. When you put it in, it's going to be needing water on a more frequent basis. As you get past a week to 10 days to 2 weeks, if it's in the ground, it's going to be okay. Now, you raise it above the ground, you put it in a planter, you put it in a pot, and it is definitely going to need to be watered every day, especially as you get toward the middle and the latter part of the summer. Because what's happened is that root system has expanded so much that it's taken up all the pore space in that soil or that medium. And you pour the water in there, and it's going to flush right out. And it's not going to have any holding capacity. And this is what you want your soil to do. And so most in-ground soil, other than pure sand, will be able to hold water in that in its pore spaces long enough for it to benefit the tomato plant for 2 or 3 or 4 days, depending on the temperatures and the wind exposure that it has. Tomato plants will oftentimes go through a midday wilt, which scares a lot of people.
Yeah.
So you see on a 90-degree day, 92-degree day, you go out there and it's like, oh, my gosh, my tomato plants are dying.
Yeah,
you go ahead and soak them, and lo and behold, voila, they come back the next morning. They look very happy. So you save them. Well, that's a normal wilting process. Okay. Of tomato plants. So it's something, it's warning you, it's saying, I'm pretty thirsty, you might want to water me.
Okay.
But as time goes on in the ground, you don't have to worry about it as much.
Okay. Does it matter what time of day?
Best time to water any time, any plant, is in the rising temperature in the beginning of the day.
Okay,
so as your temperatures go up, they can utilize the water that's there. Watering at night invites the potential problem for disease to get started because you don't have any drying effect taking place. So it kind of just sits there and you get pathogens deciding that this is a great place to start a new home. Okay. And so you want to try to discourage that.
We have an email questions about hackberries.
Oh,
this person purchased 2 hackberries from a local nursery. They've been sitting in the same spot for about 2 years. The nursery wanted to scrap them and refund the money, but I told them the roots can be pruned and the tree saved, but they're not sure. Mm-hmm. What do you think? So well, it looks like before they even got them in the ground, they noticed this.
Yeah, they are – hackberries are known for their toughness, but they're also known for being particular about the environment that they're in. And if their root systems have been spread to beyond the normal ball, chances are they may or may not make it. I've been wrong when I've said, this tree is dead. It's toast. You might as well take it out of the ground and get rid of it. Oh, let me just let it keep it in the ground for another year. So they keep it in the ground another year, and what happens? It makes me a liar, okay? Well, that's a nice thing to be a liar about. And I think that with the nursery and the hackberries, if they're going to scrap them anyway, you know, why not just go ahead and try to save the tree? Try to, you know, keep it around. Give it a little bit of fertilizer. Try to water it a little bit. See if you can get it to go ahead and get established for you so that you don't have nobody's going to lose another tree. So that's the big thing right there.
What about plants that were direct seeded right around Memorial Day? So maybe some radishes, carrots, things like that. And I know that you are supposed to start thinning them out.
Yes, yes.
That's the part where I always stop.
Did my wife send you that question?
No. This one was me because okay. I never remember to thin out seedlings, and okay. I honestly don't know how to do it.
Oh, it's easy to do.
Do you just pluck a couple and
if you put in carrot seeds, you're going to notice they're going to kind of come up like grass.
Yeah.
And if you leave them like that, then you're going to get a little punky, nothing to write home about carrots, supposedly, or carrot roots. So the best thing to do would be to go in there with little pinking shears. You know what pinking shears are?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they have the little triangle teeth.
Yeah. So you can go in there and just snip those off, every other one or every third one, to go ahead and give you a little bit of space in between.
So you don't actually have to pull them out.
No, just snip that off because you're talking about the embryonic leaf, the seed leaves that are there. That'll literally assassinate those little individual plants just by snip, 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 snip. You can pull them out if you want to, but if you pull them out next to another seedling that you want to save, that's going to disturb it and it could set it back or kill it as well. So it's just easier to get in there with a little bit of pinking shear and snip it back and let the ones that you want to grow have the room to go ahead and grow.
Well, Ron, in about 30 seconds or less, what should we all be doing before the next time you come in?
Well, keep mowing your lawn high. A lot of people are going to try to lower their mowing height as the summer goes on so they don't have to mow it as often. And if we have a hot, droughty summer, then we're going to have water restrictions, and the watering that you're going to be able to do is not going to be as good. So keep it at 2.5 to 3 inches in mowing height. Your lawn will do a lot better. Your mower will be more functional, last a lot longer, not use as much gas. The blade will stay sharper, and you won't be using as much water to go ahead and water, and your weeds won't get a chance to get established during that time period.
All right, Ron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Horticulturist Ron Smith joins us periodically during the growing season. If you have a question anytime, you can email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook, Main Street at Prairie Public. Dakota Datebook is next.
Prairie Public is proud to present the live storytelling event, The Moth, November 14th at the Fargo Theater. Tickets available now at Tickets 300 or online at jadepresents.com.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 10th. History of the Garrison Dam is forever entwined with the lifeways of the native people of the Fort Berthold Reservation in western North Dakota. The massive water project for flood control and hydroelectric power took 7 years to construct west of Underwood, North Dakota. But the massive rolled earth dam also claimed the lives of 15 workers and most of the reservation's river bottom land, which the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people had relied on for centuries for their gardens, water, and other resources. The Garrison Dam forced them to higher, windier ground, and the new town of Newtown, as the reservoir of what would become Lake Sakakawea swallowed their homes. On this date in 1953, the Bismarck Tribune rolled out its Garrison Dam Souvenir Edition, previewing President Eisenhower's visit for a ceremony celebrating the dam's closure to divert the Missouri River. The paper had dedicated two full-time reporters for 6 weeks to compile interviews and research for the special edition. One of the reporters had already been covering the dam throughout its construction with regular reports on the progress. Articles detailed the dam's design and construction, its final phases, and even the weather forecast for Ike's visit. Some stories did focus on the dam's impact to the reservation. One story featured the 12 churches that were moved to avoid the rising water. One of those was the Elbow Woods Church, which burned down in April of this year. Another story profiled the first family of Riverdale, who hoped to welcome President Eisenhower at the town site as its first residence. The same family had previously welcomed other officials and dignitaries brought in by Senator Milton Young. Newspaper ads in the Tribune compared the height of the North Dakota Capitol to the face of the dam and cheered for the president's impending visit. Another ad prominently featured the ceremony's agenda, listing Army band music, water sports exhibitions, and remarks by Governor Norman Brunsdale and President Eisenhower. The Tribune displays the framed cover of the Garrison Dam Special Edition, among other historic front pages, in a conference room at its office in Bismarck. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The Southern Baptist Convention is having a reckoning over sexual abuse.
Can we trust our church leaders to not only not be abusing, but to also be prohibiting people who could be abusers from having a place where they can do it with impunity?
Do women in the church have any power?
I think there's just something about the order of creation that means that God intends for the preaching voice to be a male voice.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, you can learn how to prevent violence with a bystander education program. We are going to learn about the Green Dot Safety Program with Melanie Feierstein and Greg Lemke of the Rape and Abuse Crisis Center. We'll also hear from Fintan Dooley. He is a land and mineral rights attorney and a member of the Salted Lands Council, which is concerned about damage caused by brine ponds and spills, as he joins John Harris on Prairie Pulse. And we wrap up the show with Republican Representative Jim Casper of Fargo as he talks to Doug Hamilton about internet privacy concerns. That's all coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your evening.